In the name of God, Creator, Redeemer, and Spirit. Amen. A few weeks ago, I went home to my parents' house in Michigan. I was beginning to think about this sermon and had read the lectionary pages for today before heading outside to take a walk around their neighborhood. When my parents moved into the home that I grew up in 30 years ago, it was a small rural community near a steer farm and a lake surrounded by tiny cottages that families would come to in the summer. In recent years, good school systems and improved infrastructure have turned this area, particularly around that lake, into a real estate hotbed. As I was growing up, more and more of these tiny cottages were torn down and turned into massive homes that took up these lots. Most of these houses are now worth somewhere between $1 and $3 million. But as I walked down the street this time, I was struck by the number of homes with large, imposing gates in front of them. I couldn't help but imagine a poor man like Lazarus lying at those gates, covered in sores and with stray dogs licking his wounds. And I wondered how we would react to such a sight today. As I began to prepare for this sermon, I found it striking that most commentaries and sermons on these lectionary passages began with a quick reassurance to the readers that these passages are not condemning wealth. The love of money, sure, but it's okay if we're all still rich. I certainly do not mention this in an attempt to condemn anyone, for I am just as guilty as everyone in this room and those beyond it of having far more than I need. But I think that underneath these reassurances, all of these pastors and theologians were cognizant of a pretty important fact. These passages make most of us very uncomfortable. Alas for those who are at ease in Zion, and for those who feel secure on Mount Samaria, says the prophet Amos. Find contentment simply in food and clothing, says the passage in 1 Timothy. And perhaps worst of all, when Abraham tells the rich man, "Child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner evil things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. Besides all this, between you and us, a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so, and no one can come from there to us." While in this parable, the great chasm is somewhere in the afterlife, I cannot help but wonder if that great chasm existed long before the two men had died. Even if physically they were not that far apart, the extreme contrast drawn between the two of them seems to make it clear that there was already a deep chasm between Lazarus and the rich man long before the exchange that we read today. And I don't think we can deny that that same chasm is also present in our world today. In fact, maybe it's even gotten worse, because Lazarus is no longer lying at our gate. He lives in a neighborhood on the other side of town that we don't have to go to if we don't want to, or on the corner of a street that we tend to avoid because we don't know what to do with the man who's holding up the sign that says that he's hungry. Or maybe he's even our neighbor, but we've never really bothered to go next door and find out. We may not be wearing robes of purple with fine linen like the rich man in the parable, or lounging on beds of ivory like the people in Amos, but most of us in this room have far more than we need. I think most of us know what side of the chasm we're standing on. But that's a really hard reality to grapple with, because what does it even mean? Is everyone who is comfortable now doomed to an afterlife of torment? Doesn't this seem to contradict other things that Jesus says? Isn't God also a God of beauty and joy and abundance? If there's anything that I have learned over my life about the Christian faith, it's that there aren't a lot of easy answers. And I don't think that this time is any different. But I also wonder if Jesus is trying to show us something more than simply condemning those with riches to hell. We are told very little about the time that Lazarus and the rich man spend on earth. In most cultural renderings of this story through art or even an old folk song that I found, most people seem to assume that the rich man just ignored Lazarus or even actively scorned him, hence the reason he deserved to go to hell. But in the actual gospel passage, we only get a couple of sentences comparing the extravagant lifestyle of one to the meager destitution of the other. For all we know, the rich man might have even sent a servant out to throw Lazarus some table scraps that he longed for every now and then. But if it wasn't his actions that separated the rich man from Lazarus, what was it? My daily work is with families who live in low-income housing. And although the nonprofit that I work for is not specifically religious, many of my families identify as having faith in some form, and they share it with me on a fairly regular basis. And the faith that these families express to me is a faith that I have never known. In each moment of their lives, they are so aware of the active presence of the divine. It might be in talking about something as seemingly small as trying to pay the grocery bills, or to something as large as navigating a world that is quick to accept stereotypes about their worth and abilities. Either way, they'll often end a conversation with me saying, "It's okay, Sarah, I know that God's got me." I've studied a lot about theology and biblical interpretation, and I can answer a lot of questions that people ask me about God or sin or even obscure ethical theories. But I think I have learned the most about what it means to have deep and abiding faith from spending time with these families. Because when you face pain and adversity on a regular basis, your faith has to be strong enough to withstand it. You have to trust that God is not only present in pain, but is actively bringing hope in the most desperate of situations. Theologian and social psychologist Christina Cleveland says that a life of privilege is often about transcendence, or living a life that is marked by avoiding or escaping systemic and societal pain. Now, this is not to say that those of us with significant means never experience any pain or suffering, but really think about it. I have a car, so I can drive away from all the places that I don't want to be, and I have an alarm system on my house to make sure that my stuff is protected. I have a paycheck that prevents me from worrying about where my next meal is coming from. And I have a community who is quick to assume the best in me, even when I make mistakes. We have agency and mobility to be able to choose our own neighborhoods, our own schools, and even our own churches that often separate us from those with lived experiences that are very different from our own. And none of these things are necessarily bad. But if we use these things to turn a blind eye to the suffering that is happening in our world, are we also missing an opportunity to see God at work? The rich man asks Abraham if Lazarus can go back to warn his brothers, to let them know that they've got it all wrong, that the life of luxury they're enjoying now is not worth the torment that he is facing. But Abraham kind of seems to blow him off. They have Moses and the prophets, he says. If they won't believe them, they're not going to believe now, even if someone rises from the dead. Because why would they need to? When you have the means to avoid pain and heartache, it's hard to believe that you also need the hope of resurrection. It would be easy for me to preach a sermon that said this parable is simply about doing some good with our wealth. I could tell all of you to leave this building and to find a person on the street, to give them some food or money or whatever, and we will all be able to avoid the fate of the rich man. But what if it's not just that the rich man didn't care to give to Lazarus, but in failing to know Lazarus, he failed to know God? What if we can't truly experience the hope of the divine, Cleveland asks, until we are able to experience the divine in the most hopeless situations? Now, don't get me wrong. I am in no way trying to romanticize or idealize poverty or systemic injustice or the pain that so many people face on a daily basis. But I think that when we give to people or to organizations or even talk about people who live in poverty, we assume that we are doing so with the upper hand. We believe that we are bringing God to the other side of the chasm. But I think the story is telling us that we have got it all wrong. God is already there and has been the whole time. We, like the rich man's brothers, have so much to learn from those who are on the other side of the chasm. But most of the time, we are too far behind our closed gates to ever really hear them. But what if we did? What if instead of turning away from our neighbors and from pain and suffering, we turn toward it? What if we visited a church one Sunday that is filled mostly with families who don't look like us and who live in different parts of the city than many of us do, and hear the stories of their faith? What if we bought our groceries one day from the store that's on the other side of town and spent some time in a neighborhood that makes us uncomfortable? What if we simply roll down our window and tell the guy on the side of the road that I don't have any cash today, but I would really just like to know your name? Because when we turn away from our gates and our walls and look to the other side, I think what we find will surprise us. And maybe that chasm that has grown between us can get just a little bit smaller. Amen.